my anticipation was they came through the door, they're going to do things that I wouldn't want to have to live with the rest of my life. So at that point, I handed my son, Cameron, a machete. He was about 13 years old, and I took another one, and we waited for him. The only thing, it was the only weapon I had, the only thing I could do was hide and wait for them to come through the front door and just try to take out as many of them before they got to us.
On today's podcast, we're going to talk about the 25th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide, and we're going to meet a man who knows what it's like to look his 13-year-old son in the eye and say, "Son, we're not going to survive the night." All that's coming up on today's Hot Zone.
This is the Hot Zone. Engaging with the news in a whole new way, international war correspondent Chuck Holton brings insight into areas of crisis and lets you help those affected.
So I've got my good friend Shane Russell on with us. Shane, I first met, I think, at Master's Mission, wasn't it?
No, actually, we met in Ethiopia.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah, we went on that trip to Ethiopia, and then I came to Master's Mission, I guess, and then later on we went to Kenya and visited you guys.
Correct.
Man, we've been around a little bit, haven't we?
Good times, yeah.
Yeah, they are. The reason I wanted to have you on today is because it's 25th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide, and I know that you were deeply involved in that. Why don't you just start by telling me your story about how you were involved in it and what happened?
Well, our family, we were missionaries in Goma, Zaire, which was on the border of Rwanda, Gisenyi, Rwanda. We're working in a mission station there that was training evangelists and pastors throughout Congo at that time in the early 1990s. And we ended up being in Kigali when the genocide started, by chance, I guess you'd say. But our youngest daughter, Kaylin, had gotten sick, and it was getting worse and worse. So we ran her to the Kigali hospital. One of the local doctors in Gisenyi said she had appendicitis. So we had a decision to make. We either take a 4-hour flight to a mission hospital or a 4-hour drive to Kigali, Rwanda. We decided to do the latter just so we'd have control of the vehicle and be involved. So we did that. It was actually 1 week before the genocide kicked off, and she had an emergency appendectomy. We stayed in town as she was recovering, and she got out of the hospital the day before the genocide on Tuesday, April the 5th, and was doing better, but, you know, still recuperating from appendectomy. But our plans were to stay in Kigali until the 7th of April and to drive back to our home in Gisenyi. Obviously our events changed, our schedule changed the night of the 6th. We were at the American Club, actually, in Kigali, Rwanda. Our daughter, after getting to the hospital, all she wanted to do is get a hamburger from the American Club. So we took her there to do that, and we were staying there watching a movie and relaxing at the American Club, and someone called and said they were shooting in town. They recommend everyone go back to where they're staying. And so we jumped in our truck and went back to the guest house in which we were staying, just outside of Kigali. Went to bed. I mean, to hear gunfire in that part of the world wasn't that abnormal. So we didn't really even think about it. Went to bed, and my wife woke me up. I'm a sound sleeper. She woke me up about, I guess it was about 2 or 3 in the morning. She said, "There's something going on outside. There's gunfire and explosions." And so we woke up and found ourselves in the midst of it. Didn't know what was happening at first until some of the security guards in the compound at the guest house said that there's the president's plane had been shot down during the night, and there was a lot of killing going on. We were in that for about 3 days. It was on Saturday before the U.S. Embassy was able to get us out. And we were able to get out by going in convoy down to Bujumbura, Burundi. I think about 33, 34 other vehicles. We tied pillowcases and sheets to our aerial antennas to signify that we were in the convoy. And we just left town, and stayed together. And on the roads, we saw things that a person shouldn't see. You're an ex-soldier. You've seen them. Passed roadblocks with militia, the Ntetahamwe, where they'd stop the road and We actually passed one who had a grenade in his hand, and he pretended to pull the pin on the grenade and throw the grenade in the back of our pickup truck. If he'd have done that, we wouldn't be here talking probably even today. But anyway, by God's hand, God's grace, made it through and got down to Bujumbura, and were evacuated from there to Nairobi, Kenya. Met the U.S. Marines in Bujumbura. Good-looking guys. Once we finally made it to the airport, and we were felt safe and secure for the first time in a number of days. And then you flew to Nairobi, Kenya. So in a nutshell, that's about the gist of it. But
now I understand that there was a moment when you felt like things were not sure by any stretch that you were going to survive the night. You know, hearing the story from your family members that there was a moment where you just had to all gather around and pray.
Well, we did. Yeah, I think you're probably thinking of the time in Goma when it was our first shooting that we went through where we did that. But obviously, when things are chaotic around you, that's what you're going to do. You're going to get down on your knees and pray and ask God to help you. And if it's his will, to get you through it. We did that night with our family. We did that. We had a local Zairean guy that was with us. And we with him prayed, and with the security guards, we were in the compound, Southern Baptist compound, with another missionary couple. They were very gracious to us and became good brothers as we just kind of went through this thing together.
So wait, let me back up. There was another time when this happened, a different time?
Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, we were actually missionaries on the field for about 2 months when we went through our first shooting. That was in Goma. You've been to Goma. You know what Goma's like. Yeah, that was Christmas when the soldiers of Zaire were given permission to loot the towns to make. That's how they got their pay. The government couldn't afford to pay them, so occasionally they'd let them loot a town. It happened to Kisangani. Probably a couple months before us, and then Christmas in 1992. That's when we were in our home on our knees praying, gunfire going all around us. We were brand new missionaries, didn't know anything, and we just prayed that God would protect us. We didn't have any idea what the soldiers were going to do. All I could think about was I have two small daughters and a beautiful wife, and I didn't anticipate the soldiers would be very disciplined. And so my anticipation was they came through the door, they're going to do things that I wouldn't want to have to live with the rest of my life. So at that point, I handed my son Cameron a machete. He was about 13 years old, and I took another one, and we waited for him. The only thing I, it was the only weapon I had. The only thing I could do was hide and wait for them to come through the front door and just try to take out as many of them before they got to us. But I'll never forget telling my son, we may not make it through the night, but we're going to die protecting our mom and the girls. So, that was kind of our baptism by fire.
And so that's a pretty difficult thing to have to tell your son.
It's a very difficult thing. And
how old was Cam when that happened?
He was 13.
He was 12.
Oh, my wife just said he was 12. So he was 12.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Yeah. So he was a young boy to have to go through that and the other kids. But, you know, on the other hand, they see and they saw that God can protect you. Mm-hmm. And he did. And we learned that night. And then 2 years later, when we're in Kigali, when the genocide's going on, we understood that if it's his will, he'll protect us.
Yeah, it's interesting to kind of explore that, especially in such a visceral way that, we're here because we feel like God's called us here. We believe that God will care for us and that he has our best in mind. But that doesn't mean that we're promised that we'll be safe. That doesn't mean we're promised that we'll live through this. But it just means that our lives are going to mean something when it's all over, right?
Yeah, there were a lot of people that didn't make it through those nights. There were believers just as well. And so really, you trust yourselves to a faithful creator and we're his. I mean, he bought us with a price. And I don't know how theological you want us to get here, but he bought us with a price and we're his and we belong to him and we're going to do his work as long as he'll have us to do it.
I think that that's very illuminating for people to hear that, especially people who aren't believers, to try to understand where you're coming from, to say, because I've heard so many of them, as I've been out like with Dave Eubanks and his family in Syria recently, people say, you know, what an irresponsible idiot to take your family to a place like that. And they just don't understand. They don't understand the concept of an eternal calling, of a responsibility before the Most High God to do what I'm called to do, whether or not that it means that I and my family are going to survive it.
Well, even as a military, it's the idea of, listen, I'm giving my life for something greater than myself. Mm-hmm. And we have to make those decisions in the ministry. Our families go with us because they're our qualifiers for ministry. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that enable us to actually do it. They do more ministry in many regards than we do, because the kids are playing with the kids, the wives are talking with the ladies. And so the family unit is crucial.
It is. Yeah. And you know, the most powerful part of that kind of ministry, when you go to places like that, many of those families have never seen a functional family. They've never seen a family where the husband honors his wife and where the wife honors her husband, where the children obey their parents. And to do life with them, it's one thing for you to go and to flap your gums at them and try to tell them about this loving God, but to display it in the form of your family and to live with them and to let them see you go through sickness and appendicitis and difficulties and face danger is probably the most powerful thing that you can do. As they say, you know, you should, as a Christian, preach the gospel always and sometimes use words. I think it's instructive for people to hear that, whether or not they're believers. Now, let's go back to the genocide in Rwanda. From a political standpoint, my understanding is that the reason that we didn't intervene as Americans is because Bill Clinton felt like politically it was unfeasible, because only several months before that had been the Black Hawk Down incident in Somalia, and nobody wanted to get into another situation like that. However, I saw a talk he gave several years later where somebody asked him about it, and he said, you know, that's something that I live with every day, because I feel like if we had gone in there, we probably could have saved half of the people who died. That's 400,000 lives. Yeah. What do you feel about that? You were there, and you were, you know, in the midst of it. How do you feel about the way that politics kind of contributed to it?
Yeah, I don't know all the inner workings of what happened. I know that the issue in Somalia was near, and it was around the same time. The only thing I know from my experience is when we were sitting in that Southern Baptist compound for those 3 days, from Wednesday night till Saturday, just beyond us, above on the rooftop of a hotel, there was some UN soldiers that had perfect aim of sight. To be able to do whatever they knew. The UN were already there. They were up and down the streets of Kigali. They could have, I believe they could have stopped it before it got started. The documentaries that I've seen since say the same thing.
Yeah.
That if they would have just gotten involved, then it never would have become an issue, but it didn't. I think later on we had the same problem in Congo. Well, in fact, I was in Congo 3 years ago, and you see the UN up and down the streets, but nothing's really being done.
Right.
Which is unfortunate.
Yeah, it is. Often they're sort of toothless tigers. I mean, they come in there, and even if they have weapons, they're not allowed to use them, and people know it. I've seen that all over the world. In Haiti, after the earthquake, there were armed troops everywhere, but the people basically said, "I dare you to shoot us for taking this aid," and they just swarmed in there and just stole all the aid, because they knew the troops wouldn't.
They're not going to do anything.
Back it up. And in fact, I just watched the documentary from PBS about the Rwandan genocide, and they interviewed the UN commander on the ground there, and he said that he had intel about where they were marshaling their troops and their munitions and weapons and stuff, planning to do this genocide, and he had an operation planned to go in and take out that arms depot. That would have put a stop to it right there. But he was specifically denied permission to do that operation by Kofi Annan, who didn't want to, you know, upset the apple cart kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, you know, seeing the things that you saw, what kind of feeling does it leave you with 25 years later?
It's amazing to me how when we begin talking about it, it still brings up emotions, even tears. I'm pastoring now. I was preaching a church on Sunday morning and just even brought to their attention that it was the same weekend 25 years ago, and just expressing that to them, tears welled up in my eyes as I think back. I think it's had long lasting results on my family. I don't think I understood that as a younger man, especially with the children, as to what they saw and how they had to handle it and go through it. I think if I could do things over again, I've been more in tune with their needs. I think, as we talked about, you see the sovereignty of God, the hand of God in it, that he takes us through those things and we trust him in that. But they still have an effect on our lives. We still, I'm not the same person I was before I went to Africa as a missionary. It's just different.
Do you miss being in Africa?
You know, I do. In fact, as this weekend approached, and I was even thinking about Rwanda, my thoughts of Rwanda are good thoughts. They're not my initial thought when the word Rwanda comes. I don't think of the genocide. I think of the good things that we saw and the lifestyle that we had and the ministry that we did there. It's a beautiful country.
Yeah, it is.
It's a secure country now from everything I hear. I was there 3 years ago, and the police are doing a great job. And the security is really good. So, yeah, I miss it a lot.
Yeah.
Miss Kenya as well.
Yeah, for sure. Well, maybe we can go back sometime. It'd be fun to go do that Ethiopia trip again. That was a good time.
It was a good time.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming on and talking to us about it. All right. Well, folks, that's it for today's Hot Zone. Thanks for being with us. I'm Chuck Holton, and we'll see you tomorrow.
The Hot Zone is produced by Amy Holton and Livefire Media. Copyright 2019.